Welcome to another round of the Best of SDHAM here on the Off the Woodwork podcast section at 92.9 The Game and the Odyssey app. John Nelson here with you. For those unfamiliar, SDHAM is the morning show for the Soccer Down Here Network, the SDH Network, airing at 9:05 for starters, Eastern Time, and goes for about 2 hours or so. We try to aim for an 11:05-ish ending, depending on other things that we have to do in the day and breaking news and everything of the sort in and around the world of soccer. Monday through Friday on the SDH Network, you can listen or watch live on the SDH Network YouTube channel, on X or on Twitch at twitch.tv/soccerdownhere. Or you can listen to the show in its entirety or some of our favorite guest stars and pundits that we have in the week in those particular segments that are posted to your favorite podcatcher. So you can catch us either in shorter form or you can catch us long form from one end of the show to the other, either live or on tape, Monday through Friday on the SDH Network. And what we like to do here is kind of give you a best of as to some of the folks that we got to catch up with during the week and find out what's on their mind as it comes to the current events in the world of soccer. First guest up this week, once again, we catch up with our friends at Apple TV and MLS 360. Studio analyst Dax McCarty gets to hang out with us for the first time. And Dax goes into what he's been thinking about, a very disappointing season with Atlanta United, and some of his superlatives so far as we reach the All-Star area with the roster being named, and one of the surprises, really, in the Western Conference and the overall. Here's our catching up with Dax McCarty. All right, Dax, welcome to the chaos that is Friday here on SDHAM.
No problem. Thank you.
So, leading into the conversations, all right, so prep. Michael said that he was at the matchup at lower.com to see Atlanta United. I'm going to throw you right into the fire since he already asked my first question.
No problem.
Atlanta United and Columbus, put a stomping in the first 45. It was 3-0. It ends up 3-1. When you look at, I guess, Columbus, that's expected that they go and they're going to put their foot on your throat, and that's an expected result. When you look at Atlanta United right now, having been with you when you were here and covered you at SDH in your time here in Atlanta, when you look at Atlanta now as someone with Apple TV, what is sticking in your mind about Atlanta United right now?
They don't have any cohesion. There's some sort of disconnect.
Accessibility shortcuts.
Sorry.
Wow.
Sorry about that.
No worries.
There's not a ton of cohesion right now with Atlanta United from top to bottom. I see a roster that of players who I see talent. I have seen talent at different moments during the season. But there is just a wild, I think, disconnect between the players and between what their strengths are, what their weaknesses are. They don't balance each other out well. And quite frankly, there's just not a ton of cohesion on the field when you look at what's happening. Look at either side of the field. Defensively, they cannot stop leaking goals. They're one of the worst teams in the league at goals conceded. They give up seemingly multiple goals almost every game. Can't even remember the last time they had a clean sheet. And then on the attacking side of the field, their big-time players haven't been good enough. And it's okay to say that. Like, I think when you sign designated players, there's a lot of factors that go into them settling. But the reality for Atlanta United is that if you're going to spend $40 or $50 million in the transfer market and have this very expensive outlay, then you don't really have the luxury of time to try to get acclimated to each other. It has to almost work in the first couple of months of the season for a proof of concept. So it's not just all down to the designated players. There are other issues that I see in midfield. But for the most part, Emmanuel Latte-Lott, Miguel Almiron, and Alexi Maranchuk have not lived up to the price tag. And when you can't score goals and then you can't defend your net consistently, you're going to end up where Atlanta United is, which is outside the playoffs looking in.
How frustrating, and I'll go ahead and say you're an alum. You spent time in Atlanta. How frustrating for you is that as an alum of Atlanta United?
Well, look at my preseason predictions. I thought that Atlanta United, with a few additions, would be at the top of the East, fighting for a supporter shield. I thought Emmanuel Latte-Lott would be fighting for the Golden Boot. And I think this is just a really good lesson that I think money buys you better players. It always has, but it doesn't necessarily buy you cohesion and success, because there's so much more that goes into it than just, let me just buy a bunch of expensive pieces and see if they fit together on the field. There's a lot more that goes into it. So I've been frustrated for sure, because I actually really love almost everyone that I encountered in Atlanta. It's a really good group of guys in the locker room. I don't know the coaching staff as well. Obviously, I didn't play under Ronnie. I played under Carl Robinson a little bit with Rob Valentino. But I really like all the people that work in the front office, behind the scenes, the kit men, the chefs, the people who sell tickets. Everyone there is really pleasant and really, really wonderful. But that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to put a winning team together on the field. And so I've been just as frustrated as the fan base, because Atlanta United gave me the opportunity to end my career on my terms. And I had some wonderful memories in Atlanta. So I, as an analyst, you have to take a step back. You can't be biased. Yeah. You have to try to be objective in how you're looking at things and analyzing things. And if I have to put my analyst hat on and analyze what's happening this year, it's just not good enough and it's unacceptable. And the players will know that. The front office will know that. The coaching staff will know that. I appreciate the candor with which Ronnie Dialis speaks. You know, he doesn't sugarcoat what's happening right now. So it's frustrating. It's never over, right, with regards to making the playoffs at this point. But I would say it would take a little bit less than a miracle for Atlanta United to make the playoffs at this point.
Apple TV's Dax McCarty hanging out with us here in the hour of chaos, as we call it here on Fridays, the last hour of the week. So then you have this time on the road where Atlanta United is away from home, and you have other tournaments being played at Mercedes-Benz, and so you get the opportunity to try to sort things out away from Atlanta United and the 17s. But you're also a month away from the summer transfer window. If things do not fix themselves in whatever terminology you want to use in air quotes, and that's a dollar in the jar for me, how, you know, hey, cliches are dollars in the jar. And at the end of the year, the boss is like, oh, look at the jar.
Love it.
How active, and I'll use that word, how active would you anticipate the summer transfer window for teams south of the playoff bar right now, Atlanta United included?
Yeah, I would think that you have to be active if you're not in the playoff picture at this point in time. But there is context and nuance into why you should be active. If you're a team like Toronto FC, then how active should you really be? The season's over for Toronto FC. So, and CF Montreal, right? Like these types of teams who, quite frankly, they don't have a chance to make the playoffs. Do you wait until the winter where you can turn over the roster a little bit faster, you can get players in and get them a full preseason? Or are you a team like the Chicago Fire who are on the outside looking into the playoffs, but they have a good enough team to not only make the playoffs, but make a run? And so there's nuances to the different teams, but I'll keep it Atlanta United focused. Sure. Atlanta United has to be active. They have to do something, because what's happening right now, what the supporters are seeing, what we are seeing as fans, it's just not acceptable. They're not even competitive in games. If you look at their last three results, 2-0 to the New York Red Bulls, 4-0 to NYCFC, and 3-1 to the Columbus Crew. Yeah. I mean, even that scoreline against Columbus flatters Atlanta. They were miles off of it. They didn't even look competitive. So you need to be active if you're Atlanta United. I actually don't know how much flexibility they have to make moves to bring players in. I would think that in order to do that, you would have to move some players out, and some players that are, you know, quite frankly, probably pretty high priced players, you know? And so you need to make moves out of the team first before you can bring people in. And I don't know. I think where Atlanta United should focus mainly is in midfield and on the back line. You're not going to be able to get rid of Miguel Almiron or Emmanuel Latte-Lott or Alexei Maranchuk. Maybe Maranchuk would have some transfer value somewhere in Europe, maybe somewhere in Russia, right? If you got an offer. But Alexei Maranchuk, to me, he hasn't been as bad as people sometimes talk about him. But again, him and Miguel Almiron, it doesn't seem like they can coexist together in a functional way. So It depends. And then with midfield, you need to bring in a defensive midfielder. That's been such a problem for Atlanta United this season, not having that spine of the team. It's been a rotating cast at center back. What do you do at center back? You have some young players in Efrain Morales and Noah Cobb, who I think have a lot of potential, but it's clear that the coaching staff doesn't trust them at this point in time. So you have Derek Williams and Stian Gregersen, who have had trouble staying healthy. I think you need to bring in a defensive midfielder and a center back in this transfer window in the summer. And then you reassess and reevaluate what you're going to do for 2026 in the offseason.
You know, you mentioned Chicago. I just like saying the word Zinkernagel myself. It's a lot of Scrabble, a lot of Scrabble points that are attached there. Let's get into, since you mentioned other teams in the Eastern Conference, I guess we can go into senior superlatives here as we head into the All-Star break. All-Star team gets announced. Snubs. We know that there were locks. We know that there were locks that attached to the MLS All-Star roster. First off, do you dig the All-Star game being the way that it is, or would you rather play MLS players playing MLS players and showcase the league in and of itself instead of going up against Liga MX or Juve's D squad or whatever?
Yeah, I mean, I think an All-Star game is a very American thing, and it's hard for you know, other people from that aren't from the U.S. that to understand why we do it. I love the All-Star game. The format with the All-Star game when I was a player was you played these big time teams, right, who were in their preseason preparations. And look, we played against Real Madrid in 2017, and I was lucky enough to be a part of that. That was incredible. It was an incredible experience. And even if, you know, some of the biggest players they had at the time, I don't think Cristiano didn't play, but, you know, they had all of the stars, right, that were there. I mean, Gareth Bale was there at the time, Marcelo, Sergio Ramos. I mean, these guys all played. And even though it's preparation for them in preseason, you still want to win. You're at Soldier Field in front of 70,000 people. And it's a fun game, right? It's almost like a training exercise, but people go to All-Star games to be entertained. So the Liga MX format has been nice. I think that it's been competitive. I think that fans have enjoyed it. But I think you lose a little bit of the All-Star feel when it becomes a really competitive game, right? You want fans to be entertained. You want players to enjoy themselves and show out. I mean, players go to the All-Star game. They don't want to get injured. So I would personally love to see an East versus West, like throwback to what we had in the early days. I think it would be great. I think it would be, especially with 30 teams in MLS now, you have so many players who are deserving. I mean, you could go the 26 All-Stars, I think all deserving. Sure. You could have another All-Star team of 26 players who would all be deserving as well. So it's difficult for players that have missed out. I mean, there are so many snubs I can think of off the top of my head. Hany Mukhtar, Sam Surridge from Nashville. They've been fantastic. Pep Biel from Charlotte, Martino Hayda from Orlando City has been wonderful, right? Andrew Gutman, Dan Lovitz, Kai Wagner. I mean, I'm just naming fullbacks here who have all been deserving to get recognition in an All-Star game. So I definitely see the novelty and the functionality of doing it Liga MX versus MLS. I think there's a lot of synergy right now between those two leagues when you look at Leagues Cup. But yeah, the All-Star game is always going to be fun. I'm looking forward to it. It should still be really fun this year.
And, you know, as we sit here and look at senior superlatives to this point of the season, who has been your biggest surprise team-wise that is north of the playoff bar currently, since we've talked about Atlanta United and below the playoff bar? Biggest surprise north of the playoff bar for you this year? Is there one?
Yeah, it's not even close. It's San Diego. My expectations for San Diego going into the season were low. I had them, I think my preseason, which, well, by the way, preseason predictions suck. No one can get them right. So I just didn't give them a ton of credit because of the fact that I was skeptical about their backline. I was skeptical about their goalkeeping situation. And quite frankly, I didn't think that they had a striker to be able to thrive in that attack with Dreyer and Lozano as wingers. They have blown the doors off of every expectation that I think anyone could have of them right now. I think they're sitting first in the West at this point in time, which is nothing short of insane. And the way that they have played, they're completely breaking the model for how an expansion team can come into MLS. They play beautiful soccer. They play entertaining soccer, and they play effective soccer, and it gets results. So I think if you put together a formula of like what is the perfect expansion team, expansion season, San Diego's living that right now. And so I know there have been other expansion teams that have been great. Chicago Fire back in the late 90s, obviously winning. I believe they won the double. I know they won MLS Cup. But LAFC, right, Seattle, even Atlanta United, when they first came into the league, I mean, really took the league by storm. So the way that San Diego's doing it has been so impressive. Anders Dreyer right now is the MVP in Major League Soccer if the season ended today. That's not a hot take. That's just a fact. But I've been so impressed with Mikey Veras and everything that San Diego's done.
No doubt about it. And I'm right there with you. I was looking at San Diego FC and I was sitting there going, I don't know. Yeah. And they have absolutely just sat there and they wagged the people's index finger at me. And they're like, not so fast, my friend.
Oh, yeah.
Before you get out of here. And first off, thank you for doing this. And now that you have the garage door opener, and know where the key is under the mat, you know that you can crash here on Fridays at any time and sit there and and shoot, you know, at 9:30, if there's ever a Greg Garza or a Michael Parker sighting and you sit there and you go, oh, I want to crash on that segment. You know, you can't. What is your best? And Kevin Egan is one of our A-listers as well. What is your best Kevin Egan story to this point of the season about life at MLS 360?
Oh, Kevin Egan's the best. I genuinely, before I say any story, I genuinely feel like I could not have gotten more lucky being able to walk into MLS 360 with the crew that we have, me knowing Bradley Wright Phillips and Sasha Kleschen well already. I know Kaylin Kyle as well. I knew her before this. But Kevin Egan is the probably the person I didn't know the best out of everyone. And he's been probably my greatest asset in terms of helping me acclimate to a new life. We lived in Atlanta together for those 6 months where I stayed in Atlanta until May, and we were on every flight together up to the studio. And just being able to have him as a sounding board and to pick his brain on things that I was curious about, things that I needed help with. He's one of the most selfless individuals that I've ever met. And he just wants everyone to thrive. And so he's an amazing person and he's very good at his job. One of the best hosts I've ever seen. Best Kevin Egan story up to this point. It's not just one single thing that he does. It's just an accumulation of things. He absolutely loves food. And so he's a big foodie. And so he'll, whenever we get to the studio, he's always on the hunt for a new restaurant, or somewhere to grab a bite to eat. And he's just a great guy. Like there's really no one single particular story that stands out, but it's his preparation. I'll tell everyone, like, for how we prep, right? We prep through the week. And as a host, your prep is a little bit different. But every single day on Saturdays in the hotel before the show, Kevin Egan goes down to the lobby. He grabs a coffee and he grabs like an overnight oats or a bagel or something from the hotel. And he sits in the little cafe area for 6-7 hours before MLS 360. And he's just banging out prep notes. He's got a notebook. It's very organized. You'll see it next time you watch MLS 360, look at the desk, look at the big notebook he has. And that's why I take my preparation so seriously, is because I've seen him do it and because I see how big of a pro he is. And he's just consistent. He's just a consistent individual who just wants our show to be the best it possibly can be. And without him, he's the team dad. I'll tell you guys that. He's the team dad and just a great dude altogether, man. So really, really grateful for everyone on our crew, but especially Kev.
If my math is correct, and I really suck at math, there will be a moment this Saturday where you will have a 10 box.
Amazing.
It will be early second half because you have 6 7-40 kicks and 4 8-40 kicks.
10 box. I don't know if we've ever had that before.
So you'll start with a six pack. And you'll go from a six-pack early second half to a 10-box, and I don't know what to call a 10-box. So, I mean, literally, this could, you could be getting critical mass in Kevin Egan's brain with a 10-box and going, we got to go, you know, one of those. I am now officially intrigued about the 10 box and what this is going to look like here coming up this Saturday. Dax, as always, great to see you. Great to have you come and crash the party. Good luck with your 10 box, sir. I wish you nothing but the best success when it comes to the 10 box and everything going on. It's great to see you charging and taking care of everything up there at MLS 360. Do not be a stranger once again. Like I said, you got the garage door opener. You know you can crash at any time.
Sure.
So just have a hell of a show, and we'll catch up with you soon, my friend. Thanks for visiting, and don't make this a first time.
All right, Sean. Thank you guys for having me. Cheers.
Always good to catch up with Dax and our friends at MLS Season Pass, Apple TV, and MLS 360. This is the Best of SDHAM. John Nelson here with you. And part of our conversations that we have on our Freestyle Fridays has to do with our friends at Beyond Goals Mentoring. Usually catching up with Greg Garza or Michael Parkhurst, both Atlanta United legends, and now giving back to the game through Beyond Goals Mentoring and beyondgoalsmentoring.com, where they have over 1,000 mentees that they are helping guide their way through all of the issues of the day on the field and off when it comes to trying to become a better soccer player and a better person and a better individual across the board. So this week it's a conversation with Michael Parkhurst, and we start off with Michael and the Atlanta United match in Columbus, a match that he attended. So we get his update on Atlanta United and the issues of the day as well. And this is where we bring in Michael Parkhurst. So are they scoring goals, Cap?
Negative.
What?
We got shut out last week, 2-0.
What?
No bueno.
I mean, come on now. If you were in that locker room, I mean, what would you be discussing with them? And this is, you know, outside of Kano. This is not any kind of Kano discussion, but it's like, what would you be talking to those players about? It's like, you know, put the biscuit in the basket kind of a thing. I mean, so what kind of conversations do you have when you have an offensive drought like that?
Yeah, I'm just trying to give them confidence. Maybe let them score a little bit in training. Just let them know that, hey, it'll happen type thing. I'm not going to give them any advice because the last thing a striker wants is a defender to tell him how to put the ball in the back of the net.
Yeah. Right. True.
So, yeah, just try and give him a little pickup, like, hey, man, you know, we'll get there. And just try and do our part in the back of, you know, try and keep a zero because, you know, it's easy to say, well, just keep it 0-0. But a lot of pressure on the defense.
Yeah, because then, you know, hey, you know, you put the pressure on the defense, and if you end up with no goals scored, then at the end of the day, at least you get out of there with a point. But, I mean, right now, the Eastern Conference is a street fight. No shock. Right now, if the season ended today, which it is not, Rhode Island would be in the playoffs in the postseason as the eighth seed in the East. But you've got what? You have six teams separated by 6 points, north of the playoff bar, south of the playoff bar. So everybody knows what you were getting into in USL Championship with Rhode Island, and it's a different kind of bullseye considering that the run you – that reminds me. Man, I've got to get the gear from last season. I've got to add that to my stacks. But, I mean, everybody knows what Rhode Island is bringing to the table now. So you're kind of working with a bit of a bullseye on your chest at the same time, and everybody's kind of gunning for you the year after you made the run that you did in 24.
Totally. That's what you have to deal with success. Everybody's after you, especially when you knock – 3 teams out of the playoffs as a first year team, right? Those teams especially have a target on you. So yeah, that's part of playing as the favorite. But like we tell all of our mentees, right? That pressure is a privilege, right? We earned that. And so now you got to deal with it and step up. So I think we will.
And you mentioned the whole idea of pressure is a privilege. And I mean, if you're not being pressured, and if you're just kind of going out there and you're either being underestimated or overestimated, and there doesn't seem to be any pressure, how do you tell your mentees not to rest on their laurels if the external factors aren't there where the pressure isn't coming from the outside? How do you tell your mentees to, like, look, you've still got to be 100%. You can't just sit there and don't focus on the outside. Focus on what's going on in here so you can continue to grow and improve. Even if the noise isn't there, there still should be stuff that you have to respond to on a daily basis.
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's just not being complacent, right? Complacency is a killer. And so, right, being in that situation can be great for confidence. And that's important. But understanding that there's always a next level. There's always a higher goal. There's always something better that we can become at, a tougher environment and tougher opponents and bigger goals. So, yeah, it's constantly just challenging yourself and understanding, hey, I'm not there yet. I'm not a finished product. And that's difficult. But, yeah, that's what the best players are constantly doing. They're constantly challenging themselves and they're constantly trying to prove someone or people in general wrong.
How hard is it to challenge yourself when you don't feel like either you're A, being challenged, or, you know, you're not being challenged yourself, or that there's something wrong where the challenges aren't challenging? Does that make any sense? You know, mm-hmm. when you don't feel like the level of the challenge is there, how do you maintain your own quest and try to become better if the external stuff you don't think is matching your own level?
Yeah, we talk to younger players a lot about how there's always going to be players, teams, maybe even coaches that you come across, and you either can be infectious on them or they can be infectious on you. And so players that aren't taking practice seriously and kind of goofing around, and they can have an effect on players that initially had good intentions for that day, or the opposite can happen, right? Of course. And so we talk to them a lot about, hey, making sure that you are having the infectious behavior and not being the one affected. And that's difficult. So, constantly just trying to improve your own play. And I get when the challenge isn't quite what you want it to be, you need to create those internal challenges and have those goals set for yourself to keep pushing, or to work on your leadership skills, or something a little bit out of your comfort zone. And then obviously at some point you're going to need to get into a different environment.
If a game is a blowout and it's a team that you're completely and totally overblowing, you're overmatched, they're overmatched, you're taking care of business, how difficult is it in those challenges to, I don't want to sit here and say, you know, take mercy on the other guy and make it look like you're being, you know, a honk, you know, when a situation, you know, there's a comfortable win in a blowout, and then there's something that can get completely and totally out of control where you could be demoralizing the other guy. Where is that balance of working on yourself in a game that's a blowout, that you know that you're blowing the other guy out, to where you're still working on your own game, but at the same time you don't look like that the rest of the world doesn't think you're a jackass because it's a, you know, like a 7-2 thing. And it's like, I'm working on me and I'm doing my best. And, you know, this is what's happening, to try not to take blame in a situation.
Yeah. I think there's a difference between really stepping on the gas and trying to embarrass an opponent versus, hey, you're playing the game the right way. And I think that's the biggest thing in the in a blowout, is to still have the respect for the opponent. I see it all the time on baseball fields when it gets to be a blowout and kids start chirping and just goofing around in the outfield or goofing around on the infield, and just that is disrespecting the opponent, disrespecting the game. So, and the same thing can happen in soccer. So that's the biggest thing for me, because there will be a day when you're on the other side of a butt kicking, and you'll see how it feels. And when the other team maybe unnecessarily scoring goals, but they're still doing the things that made them successful as far as, you know, being organized and communicating and passing the ball well. You can do a lot of things and still not run up the score. That's part of it.
You mentioned, you know, respect and chirping and disrespect and those kinds of things. I know that we have generational disconnects, and I'm 702 years old, and I probably look at things a little differently than a lot of folks. But how much respect do you see out there with your mentees, and respect and understanding of what they need to work on, and how much correcting has to be done with those of the ages of your mentees, where they have to be steered back and not be disrespectful and chirping? And because I know chirping can have its positivity at points, but how do you sit there and steer them away from the negative aspects of chirping and showing disrespect? Is it something that you have to work on at all and address?
Here and there, but it's rare for us. And maybe that's just the players that are coming to us. But we've found it pretty rare. There is an occasion where a parent is honest and says, "Hey, my kid's got this going on, and I can't get through to him, and need some help in that regard." So there has been the instance where we're trying to let them know how to have respect on the field and why it's important to have that respect. And but it's not too often. So I will say that, in general, most of the kids have pretty good respect out there.
Yeah, well, and so what is it like for you and for Greg and your other mentors that I imagine are still closer and closer to signing their contracts? Are you going to have the picture, by the way, when your new mentor signs, and you're going to have the whole are you going to have like the contract and the BGM background and the looked up and the smile and the I look like I'm signing the contract and I'm smiling at the camera. Are you going to have that signing, by the way, when you have your new mentor?
No, we've talked about this. We actually talked about this with her last week, because we don't. And she's a little bit naive because she's a younger pro. Uh-huh. As far as, I don't want to put her in a place where I've seen people do a lot of things off the field as a professional athlete. And when things are going well, that's great. And when things aren't going well, all of a sudden, coaches, GMs, teammates, fans can be like, this person should do less of that and more focusing on soccer, even though there's plenty of time in the day to do these things away from job number one. And so just being respectful of her, I don't want to make this a huge, huge deal, because this is very secondary to her career, which is just getting underway. So she's been really busy with national team stuff along with NWSL schedule. So we haven't really locked down when we can announce yet, but hopefully, I think she's with national team stuff this week and maybe back next week. So hopefully in the next couple of weeks we'll be able to get something. But yeah, nothing crazy to try and keep it low key for her.
Okay, so when you have younger players, you know, trying to be supportive in a team environment, and you know, and we saw this, and the reason I kind of steered this way, we saw this in the matchup with Atlanta United in Columbus. Were you there, by the way?
I was.
Okay, so I don't know if you saw what was going on at the beginning of the second half, where Noah Cobb is trying to be there and be supportive and you know, address the energy of everybody out there on the field. And Noah wasn't part of the 11 that was out there playing at the beginning of the second 45, but he was out there, you know, dapping players up and things like that. When it comes to that kind of behavior, what's it like for you to see someone who isn't, regardless of age and level and experience, to see someone who's not a part of the starting 11 sitting there and trying to raise the energy level up of your teammates in a situation like that? What's it like for you to see a younger player take that mantle and address that issue and sit there and it's like, okay, guys, you know, beginning of second half, let's rock and roll? What's it like for you to see that kind of activity from a younger player?
Yeah, it's nice. It shows maturity. It shows a level of care, right? So many players are just in it for themselves. So it's easy when you're on the bench to be like, ooh, well, in a blowout like that, whew, thank God I'm not on the field.
Yeah.
Or obviously the other way is to be upset that you're not on the field and upset at the coach and upset at the other players that I'm not getting my chance. And you kind of stick to yourself. And, you know, that's definitely what I see from at least one player on the Atlanta United bench. But yeah, that's just the type of person Noah is. So I'm not surprised, but yeah, that's great. It's great for the team. Because yeah, they needed some energy and, he obviously saw that and was trying to do whatever he could.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, and that can be taken one of two ways, and you hope that it's taken in the most positive way possible, where, and I know that in some circles, and I'm going to, you know, step away from Atlanta United, I'm fairly certain that there are veterans in some situations, regardless of where you're talking, it's like, well, you know, what is he doing? It's like, he's not out here. What is he doing? I'm going to focus on me. And then that negativity, you know, continues to fester in those moments. But I would imagine it would take a true professional to understand where that player is coming from, regardless of level of experience, about trying to make sure that the messaging is best and that the effort is the best heading into that situation where you can improve your lot in that second 45, say.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that a lot of it is timing. A lot of it is personality. Right. Who is it that's saying it? Their energy level. You can tell a lot as a player of where this is coming from. Is it genuine? Is it real for the team, the energy wise, or is this selfish somehow? Right. And it's one thing if he's trying to, from the side of the field, get somebody going right after you give up a goal and kind of like pick somebody up or something, like then the guy on the field might be like, you know, F off right now. But if you're coming off of halftime, you know, it's purely just a get the energy going type thing. And I think that players know that Noah, by the way he carries himself, is a genuine person and wants the team to do well. So I think those little things make a difference, right? If it was a player that, you know, has a bad attitude generally and is doing it, you kind of shrug it off and be like, dude, go back to the bench. I don't need it right now.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so and that's why – character and holding yourself well is important, because you know, in moments like these you're viewed differently based off of your character and how things have been portrayed over time.
How many discussions do you have with mentees about their character, whether it's an adjustment or a reinforcement? How many conversations do you have about character specifically with your mentees?
A ton. Because when I asked a college assistant coach, what's the number one red flag when you're watching a player? He said body language. And body language is such a big component of character. And not, you can have a great character and terrible body language, don't get me wrong. But in general, they go together. And character is such a huge piece. And I think that sometimes younger athletes don't realize how important character and the way you hold yourself and the way you conduct yourself is versus how well you pass a ball, kick a ball, score, and all these other things. And of course, those things are important, but you can do those well and have terrible character, terrible body language, and you will not have the opportunities that you would if those things were different.
How many, and I'll go back to the great character, poor body language thing in a second. How many coaches reach out to you and to Greg to get intel on mentees? How much of a conversation piece is that in that two-way street with you guys?
Yeah, we always, for our mentees, tell them to put us down as references. So there have been some, not a ton, honestly, but you know, we do have small check-ins every now and then, or you know, tell us about this guy, or how's the family, or little things like that. It's never anything to do with soccer.
Yeah.
It's always just off the field stuff. And you know that, but that's important.
Okay. So great character, poor body language. How does that look? I mean, you know, is
selfish.
Well, it's break that down for me. How does that look to the eye, so we know what we're staring at? Because we can all see great character, great body language, but you could have somebody who's great character and poor body language. How does that look?
It looks either selfish or it looks deflated, in my opinion, right? Where you can have, you know, a great character who's got poor body language, right? At Atlanta United right now. Or I'll take Atlanta United 2017.
Okay.
2018. Yeah. Miguel, great character in the locker room, great human being, terrible body language out on the field. Right? Constantly getting upset with guys about making mistakes and, you know, not playing the right pass at the right time and these little things like that, which can drag on guys. And, you know, that was addressed and he got much, much, much better about it. And now I think his body language is way, way better in general. So that's one example. But you can also have, in these instances, a great character that's just sick and tired of the way things are going.
Yeah.
And that's kind of normal in this regard. Yeah. But I could see, like, you know, even Brad's body language on Wednesday was good, right? Even if he's constantly, like, he knows he's got two homegrowns in front of him, right? It's not going to be perfect. Things have not been good. So anytime he had the opportunity to pat a guy on the back, you know, say good job, right, he was doing it. Right. Even after he makes a big save, like, hey, man, whatever he's saying, but it looks positive. He's trying to bring positive energy instead of just another one I got to dig out of the back of the net. Right. And that's difficult. It's really difficult, especially when times are like they are right now.
I was going to ask how hard is that to continue to. I was about to use the word spin, but that's not right. To lean into the notion of finding a positive, finding encouragement, making sure that those younger players or the inexperienced players that are out there having to perform in a situation so they don't get dragged down and get dragged down into a negative in a situation that's already negative. How hard is that to try and be positive, find a positive, and be encouraging in a situation?
Yeah, it's difficult, but I mean, that's where it's important to have some veteran guys on the field as well, because, you know, these homegrowns, it's not their fault that Atlanta United is not doing well right now, right? It's not expected that these guys are going to lead the team and these players are going to be the ones that are going to turn things around or whatnot, right? They're taking the brunt of it, especially being on the back line. Were they mistake-free? Of course not. Do you expect them to be mistake-free? No. You know, and anyone can go to Columbus and get embarrassed. That's a pretty easy place to go and get embarrassed. And so, you know, I think Brad understood that and knew that, okay, it's not on these guys. It starts a little higher up the field. Maybe it starts with the approach from the team and the energy and things. There's a lot going on there. So, yeah, that's why it's important to have, you know, some veteran guys that can pick these young guys up and let them know, hey, keep going, man, keep going. This is a learning experience. It's not on you. Learn from it. You know, and try and find those small little positives.
Adam at Parkhurst on the 280 character app, at BG Mentoring on the 280 character app, BeyondGoalsMentoring.com, and the Friday Free Kick with our buddy Michael Parkhurst. How frustrating was it for you to go to lower.com and see what you saw out of Atlanta United on the midweek?
Yeah, it's pretty crazy. I was thinking about it.
Were you mumbling words, you know, that you shouldn't be saying publicly under your breath at points?
No, it's just no, because it wasn't all that unexpected, to be honest. Okay. Right? I think that the way things have gone, and shoot, I see Columbus play pretty often. They're a very good team, and but that being said. That was every bit of a 3-0 scoreline at halftime, right? It could have been 5.
Yeah.
It really could have been. And, you know, maybe Atlanta had a chance. So, yeah, it was tough to watch. Yeah, and I know that they're trying to fix things and trying to have the right attitudes. And I was at the hotel and got to catch up with a few guys and – Energy seemed pretty good and all those things. So, yeah, it's just, it's tough. It's tough to see, it's tough to watch, and that's never good. I mean, the response in the second half was good. They could have easily made it 3-2 to get back in it. So that was good to see.
How hard is it to be patient with what is, to what you see the younger guys out there, they're learning and all this kind of stuff. And I know that expectations are one thing, and especially coming into the season, expectations being what they were. But, you know, when you kind of see things, you see younger guys as an alum, how hard is it to be patient? And it's like, okay, let's turn this around. Does that make any sense? How hard is it to see what you see, be patient with the young guys, and hope that things turn around? How hard is that?
It's easy to be patient with the young guys. It's the older guys. It's some of the other players that you have less patience for, because, you know, like, to be honest, the fans have had patience for the last 5 years. So, you know, it's running out, and there's been moments for sure in between there, but not enough. Yeah. And, you know, I think that the club realized that, and that's why they spent a ton of money in the off season. And, you know, when that doesn't turn to results, obviously people get frustrated and guys start pressing and everything. So yeah, it's not good. It's easy to have patience with the homegrowns on the field, because it's based off expectations. And to be fair, I think a lot of the homegrowns are a lot of our best players in some of the games, right? Will's energy seemed to really turn things around in the second half. So, you know, he was a bright spot, and it seems like that happens a lot these games, where it's like you come out of it and say, oh, this homegrown or that homegrown was our best player, or the energy. And that's not good. Not good when you've got guys that you've paid 10 plus million for out on the field. And to be fair, I thought Miguel was very good against Columbus.
Yeah.
One of his better games. And, you know, obviously Lotte is really struggling right now. I thought he was terrible, to be honest, and should have had a couple goals, or at least more opportunities and things. So yeah, it's the patience is tough in general for the team, but not for the homegrowns.
And you mentioned pressing, and you know, it's, I think that and this is just me who has covered sports and not played it professionally, but I would imagine that pressing is a delicate dance, where you're pressing and you don't want to turn it into something where you're pressing too much and too much and too much. You want to press to improve, but in the desire to improve, sometimes you press too much and you go past that point of improving, and it goes the other way. It almost, mm-hmm. Seems like it's not a straight line. It's a curve almost.
Totally. And the easy example of that is like a striker, when they get a big opportunity and they should pass the ball for an easy assist, but because they haven't scored in a while, they try and shoot and it's not the right option and things like that. So it just clouds your judgment a little bit, where it's all you can think about is scoring the goal versus, hey, have a good performance and, you know, the goals will come. But for every player, it's a little bit different of how they want to get out of it. You know, some guys need to get away from the game just a little bit. You know, some guys need to really work extra out on the field, right? It's just a comfort thing. So it's different for each player. And yeah, I think Lotte for sure needs to figure it out for himself.
How much did you press at times when you were trying to help correct a situation in any of your professional outings? Did you press a lot? Did you press any?
Yeah, there were times I pressed where it was like, okay, hey, I really need to be better. I really need to be more reliable today. I can't have turnovers, you know, building out of the back. I specifically thinking back to Columbus, my last year of, you know, my center back partner was always changing, and the season wasn't going that well. And it's like in those moments, you want to be someone that team can rely on, and you know, okay, I got to be good today. And sometimes when you press that much, you get a little bit more nervous and things just don't seem to go your way when you're pressing. You know, we've talked about it before, when things aren't going your way and you give up penalty kicks or the they're not called for you, or the ball bounces off the post and goes in instead of goes out. And it's the same thing individually when you're pressing and you're putting too much on every little moment. You know, those moments don't go your way as often.
And, you know, it's, I would imagine it is probably one of the biggest things to tackle as a professional athlete is correction, whether, you know, not necessarily from yourself, but a team correction and being in your part of it to try and be a part of a larger picture and not be saddled or not put too much of the pressure on yourself to be a part of that correction to where, okay, we can all do this together instead of being an individual. Yeah, I can fix this. And then it turns into more and more and more of a problem because you put too much of that responsibility on yourself trying to fix something.
For sure. 100%. Yeah. And it's the pressing stuff and it's difficult and there's no easy answer. And that'll always be the challenge for players. Right. And that's honestly what separates the great players from the good players is their ability to get out of those situations quicker and to bounce back quick and to not get into the position where you need to press, or understanding for themselves, okay, I am pressing. How do I get out of this and get back to a good flow state?
Okay. All right. So what is your flow state currently with Beyond Goals as we prepare for that day where we get the sign? I want the signing picture where the, you know, looking up and signing and I'm nowhere close to the signature line. But what's the latest with you?
Other than mentoring, just working on the college programming so that we can help guide players that want to play in college at each stage of high school. So that's a big thing that I got going on right now.
Okay. All right. It's that time where we welcome someone else into the stacks and we'll see what's going on. So let me bring in the new team right here. Three-way dance. Do you recognize this gentleman?
What is going on here?
Back?
Look, you steal my thunder? What's going on? I'm stealing your thunder.
Well, Dax, traditionally at 9:30 on Friday mornings when they're not conquering the planet, we usually have Greg Garza and Michael Parkhurst on to talk about mentoring and, you know, what's going on in their world in Rhode Island FC and you know, lack of offense and things like that. And so basically, I was filibustering until hopefully you would come in at 10 o'clock so Michael Parkhurst could ask you a question.
Oh, God.
About what's going on in the world of Dax McCarty, because he's done this he's done it with Ozzie Alonso already this season coming into this 10 o'clock slot. So Michael Parkhurst, co-host here on the Freestyle Friday, your question for Dax McCarty.
Dax and I were on an event the other night.
I just saw Parky.
I'll ask you the same question I asked Brad.
Okay.
Toughest part of the new gig.
Oh, God. The biggest challenge is the preparation, for sure. It's funny because when you play in MLS for as long as I did or as long as Parky did, there's maybe this preconceived notion that your knowledge of the league and what you already know about it, it's just going to be like riding a bike. You just step off the field, and it's like the conversations that we had, Parky, like in the meal room at breakfast or at lunch, where we're just talking shop, right? We're talking about the opponent and tactics. That's so easy just to do it with your teammates because you're unfiltered. You give your strongest opinions and you exchange ideas, and it's so easy. So you think, oh, I'll just do that same thing on TV. And it's like, no, it does not work like that at all. You want to still give your strong opinions. You want to be as unfiltered as you can be, but you also have to prep, and you have to prep significantly more than I think what my initial anticipation was, because talking with no pressure, with face to face with someone who you're close with, is a lot easier than just going on TV cold and being like, all right, here's why Columbus is so good. Here's why the New York Red Bulls are so good. You actually need to be able to back that up with the eyeballs, and then also with some data that you intertwine in there. So the preparation is definitely something that threw me for a loop.
Yeah. Michael, as always, thanks again for dropping in and fixing the world's problems as you and Greg do at 9:30 on Friday mornings. Be well, my friend, and we will catch up with you next time. And thank you for taking the co-host duties, as you always do, and we bring in the new guys when it comes
always to- a pleasure. And happy happy belated birthday, John, by the way.
Oh, thank you. Yes, 702, by the way.
You guys have a good weekend.
Mark, you're a legend. I would like to keep seeing you at least once a week. This is a nice moment for me.
This is nice.
Once again, that's Michael Parkhurst, Beyond Goals Mentoring at beyondgoalsmentoring.com. This is the best of SDHAM. John Nelson here with you. And once again, we are also not just covering the activity in Major League Soccer or the Club World Cup, but we're also keeping an eye on Gold Cup and the continuing advancements as we come into the round of eight here this weekend when it comes to both the Canadian men's national team and the U.S. men's national team. And what we've been doing occasionally during the Gold Cup this season is catching up with our friends at Footy Prime. And for this go-round, as Canada has advanced out of the group stage and they've got a big matchup in the Sunday play in the Gold Cup, we caught up with Amy Walsh. And Amy Walsh is a part of the Footy Prime network, former Canadian women's national team player, former WUSA star in Atlanta with the Beat. And we caught up with her about the Canada-El Salvador match, which was not a very pretty match, one that Canada's men's national team survived, and her thoughts on Jesse Marsh in general. Here's our conversation with Amy Walsh. All right, hot tag. Dylan goes. That means that we go, and we break down everything that happened and everything that happened with the Canadian men's national team and anything else on the mind of Amy Walsh as our information exchange program continues here on SDHAM. And so we bring in Amy from Footy Prime. And so, Amy, I give you full props for having the background. This is not my normal studio space. I'm in a hotel. So normally you would see a massive studio space with a bunch of scarves behind, but I give you full credit for scarves behind you. Thanks.
Thank you. Yeah. Real pleasure. I think you spoke to Craig Forrest last week, so he always sets a high bar.
Well, Sharms, I don't know if you know the story, but I've known Sharms for about 20 years.
I'm sorry.
Years. And yes, we used to work in Canadian Amazing. Television together, and so that's where it started back at the Score. And so this has come back through all of these things. The reason that we bring you on is because we wanted to have our Gold Cup discussion about what happened last night. So I'm gonna phrase it this way: what in the blue-ish was going on last night in that matchup with Canada? ? Thought bubble over the head. What in the hell was going on there? It was Gold Cup after.
Yeah, it was a bit of a gong show, quite honest. You could throw a couple more expletives in there as well. But I mean, that is fuel and ammunition for people who do not love the beautiful game. Right? People who are just trying to get into it, hoping to support our Canadian men's national team, and you tune into that, you're not retaining any fans as a result. But that was, you know, by design, by El Salvador trying to get something out of that match, that was anti-football played to its fullest. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, credit to them to try to employ a tactic that was going to get Canada off their game, but it just was basically unwatchable. And I thought it was a shameful display, quite frankly. I mean, not only in the cynicism and in the way that they wanted to play this stop-start game and try to take Canada off their game plan, but in how reckless and dangerous a lot of those tackles and those challenges were. So that was like CONCACAF at its purest, but like ratcheted up, like on steroids. And I've dealt with that. I've experienced that as a player. I played 10 years for our women's national team. Played at two World Cups, played at an Olympics, went through a myriad of CONCACAF qualifying tournaments and CONCACAF-ery. So you're well seasoned in it, but it's never to that degree. So that was unfortunate as a display of football. But I think our men's team and Jesse Marsh back on a touchline was able to keep their heads, keep their wits about them. They weren't able to cash in. I think it wasn't their best half of football, but I think it's unfair to say that they were poor. They were maybe sloppy at times. They lacked solutions. They didn't attack the box often enough. Didn't really get down the spine to kind of manipulate the opponent to then go to the wing to send in those crosses. Promise David, who has been highly touted coming in, finally gets paired with Jonathan David up at the top. And he had some opportunity, but wasn't really involved. But then the second half, and then obviously the game state at that point, Canada's up two men, and they played a lot quicker. They were more incisive, but you had the space to do it. You had a team that was sitting back, and El Salvador, to their credit, remained resolute and a little bit belligerent, stubborn and organized. But you finally saw the two central midfielders in Mathieu Chouinard, who has been very good on set pieces for Canada, but Nico Seguir, who he himself got like the Coles Notes intensive CONCACAF kind of education all in 90 minutes with his young career with this men's national team, is also eligible to play for Croatia. So that's a feather in Jesse Marsh's cap, but he's involved in setting up Tejon Buchanan for Canada to double their lead, and Mathieu Chouinard sets up John David to finally put Canada on the board. So they're able to put that behind them, thankfully, and then they face Guatemala on Sunday in the quarterfinals.
Amy Walsh from Footy Prime hanging out with us to break down the CONCACAFery. Is that two F's or two?
I think one? Given the way it's gone and we want to use an F-bomb, I think it has to be two F's, John.
CONCACAFery attached to a 2-0 win that was, I swear, in looking at that match, you literally were trying to figure out, okay, just how many red cards El Salvador wanted in that match. And we in the network have never been a fan of Joe Dickerson, and it's more just because of how he wants to insert himself into matches in Major League Soccer and be the center of attention. You know, basically almost the Veruca Salt of referees when it comes to Major League Soccer. And to be fair and to be clear, it was not a reflection of his normal behavior patterns that we see. It was just coincidence that in this match, we had Joe Dickerson in the middle for a match where literally, I mean, you had, and I'm in a chair here that actually rocks backward, and so I'm kind of shocked.
You recovered well.
Literally, well, it's just like, I'm like, oh my God, and I'm falling out of the chair. You literally had so many elevated 2-foot tackles from El Salvador and players. Literally, it was like they were auditioning for, they were auditioning for Felipe Alou at Jerry Park. I mean, it was that bad.
Yes, I love the Expos reference, but yes, 100%. And I think he did, to his credit, Dickerson, he did a good job in the first half in maintaining a semblance of control, where he realized, you know, what they were attempting to do. He awards the penalty. John David misses it. You have, and then that again, this is Canada getting more seasoned as a group, as a collective, in how to navigate these tournaments and these qualifying matches effectively and more astutely, right? Where you have an Alistair Johnston, you think back to last summer's Copa America, I believe it's Copa America, where he gets headbutted. And he drops to a knee, and he's spoken himself, like he plays for Celtic, like he's a legend in Glasgow now, right? And he said he would have gotten absolutely crucified if he'd rolled around and writhed around on the pitch the way that the opponent does. But after John David's penalty is saved, it goes to the corner, Tejon Buchanan is cleaned out, they win the free kick, the referee awards it, Dickerson does, and then Alistair Johnston comes in to try to get the ball, and then it's a flying elbow to his head, and to his credit, and I say this with some reservation, he hits the deck. There's no rolling around. He's not overly theatrical, but that's the caginess and kind of the savoir-faire that you need as a Canadian. Like, you're not going to roll around and do all that sort of stuff, but you have to play the game to a certain extent. And I think Canada did that effectively. But to go back to the referee, I think there's that one tackle by De Fougerolle in the first half. He gets the ball cleanly. Maybe you could argue that his cleat's a bit high. And then the referee awards him a yellow card. He's cautioned for it. He goes in the book. Doesn't make sense. But then at the beginning of the second half, prior to Canada scoring, John David makes his way right down the gut. And he's a two-footed tackle. He goes down. So there's been rumors of him going to Juventus, right? So this is like, he's going to go somewhere. He's going to have a landing spot that is going to send him like on this upward trajectory in the discussion already in the best strikers in the world. But he goes down for a bit after that tackle. It's not even called for a foul. That in itself could be a sending off. And I think at that point, your referee is worried about the game continuing. If you award another red card, do you have enough players to keep this thing going, right? So like, I don't think that should really enter into the discussion. But yeah, I think well managed in a situation that you never want to find yourself in as a referee. It's just absolute gong show.
Five reds would have gotten you a forfeit, and you were two there on the field. You get a third for, I'm guessing, one of the coaches that basically
had, I think it was the physiotherapist, if I'm not mistaken. In addition to, I think, an assistant coach who got sent off. So what's the physio saying to the referee in order to get red carded? I have no idea.
I'm sure that I'd love to know what the magic words were. I mean, at short of a la sandwiches to get a red for a physio. I know a lot of folks here south of the Peace Bridge are intrigued over Jesse Marsh and how he has turned into basically a wrestling heel, a bad guy, you know, when it comes to cutting his promos and you know, pointing fingers and, you know, mouthing off and saying things about United States soccer and all this kind of stuff. How has his vociferous nature, we'll call it that, how has his vociferous nature been reacted to by Canadian reporters, players, fan base? How has he been received in this short
term? I think recently, given the allegations and the potential extension of his original two-match ban that he got as part of Nations League, then his accusations when the Whitecaps went down to play the CONCACAF Champions Cup final about them being allegedly poisoned, I think that Jesse Marsh, not in terms of the Canadian fan of the game or just the Canadian sports fan, I think people are paying attention to Jesse Marsh, but I think CONCACAF maybe had it out for Jesse Marsh a little bit. And so those claims are refuted. So he's up in the box at BC Place, and they had video and audio evidence to refute the accusations of CONCACAF. So I don't think that he's endearing himself to the Federation or to the Confederation, rather. But in terms of Canada, and then the way that he stood up for Canadians, like elbows up with Donald Trump's comments, he has almost a free pass, I think, because Canadians for a long time, he's instilled a belief in this squad, in these players, I think. And, you know, John Herdman started that, to give credit where credit's due. And Jesse Marsh has taken it and run with it. And he's talked about the identity of Canadians, about the hard work, the like sort of the foundational aspects of what it means to be a Canadian and wanting that to be on full display. He's endeared himself to Canadians for sure. So I think there was a little bit of chatter that he was making himself, maybe, whether unintentionally or otherwise, the center of attention, that had become a little bit of a sideshow. I disagree with that. And I think that even if it was a slightly performative aspect to the fact that he got sent off as part of Nations League, the fact that he publicly and sort of took a hit, the two-match ban, to stand up for his players because he felt like Canada continually don't get a fair shake in CONCACAF, that we continually don't get the calls, CONCACAF don't want Canada to progress because maybe we're not the big draw, or maybe there's a preference for others. I think Canadians have absolutely loved that. So I think the support is there, and I think he definitely has the players drinking the Kool-Aid, and they're in a good position now. But now they're at a point where the results really matter. So you've got the underlying performances, you've got the big swing from the 6-0 win versus Honduras to a disappointing one versus Curaçao, maybe slightly more convincing in this match that we're talking about, where they're able to get the victory when it mattered against El Salvador to see themselves through to knockouts. But now that they've got to deliver, I think, on the promise of a trophy, and then they're on to something. But I think Jesse Marsh has the full backing, not only of his players, but of the pundits and the fans in Canada.
Yeah, it seems like it's almost Goldilocks and the Three Bears, where it's like, you know, this bet is too hard, this bet is too soft, this bet is just right so far when it comes to the tournament. How much of the sideshow do you think is to purposefully purposely and purposefully distract so the team can focus on itself off the field and become, you know, a group of one where if I'm the one making all the noise, you're not focusing on all the stuff that's going on the field. Is there any play in that at
all? There might be. I don't know if it's, well thought out is probably not the right word, but I mean, I don't think he's really trying to manufacture something. I think he wants it to be organic, but I think he was maybe shielding his players a little bit and taking those bullets kind of publicly. So his players were freed up a little bit. Internally, at least, so that they could feel protected in a sense, so that they could navigate this tournament on their own terms. But I think you're seeing, to go back to the on pitch and his ability to field an 11, especially versus Honduras, that I could not have predicted, and that you've got a depth suddenly, not only across that front line, but a doubling up of positions where you've got intense competition. Each time you're naming an 11, and then you're projecting forward to next summer's World Cup, and this team is in really good stead, as you think you've got a whole other year of development for youngsters like a Nathan Saliba, who's done really well, a CF Montreal player that I've covered for the last 3 or 4 years, who's had a little bit of an uneven club performance, but looks like he's on his way to Anderlecht in Belgium, and that he will have a year to do that. He had Nico Seguir, who I've always already mentioned, a promise David, who is going to stay at Union Saint-Gilloise and continue to ply his trade there. And so lots of upside for this team, a super high ceiling. But again, they have to start delivering on results. But I think this team with Jesse Marsh as the leader are in a really good position now to make some noise at this Gold Cup.
Who do you think has the highest upside when it comes to promise? And I mean, you look at, let's just say the starting 11. Let's look at the starting 11 from last night. Obviously, Max Crépeau, we know about Max Crépeau, can stand on his head at any given time. Johnston, Fougerol, Cornelius, Richie Larea, Sigurd, Schwanier, who had the highest ranking from SofaScore last night at an 8.0. Tejon Buchanan, who is now back to being healthy. Jacob Schaffelberg, who has proven himself to be a pain in the butt for anybody that wants to go see him and play it against Nashville. And then the two Davids up top. Who do you think has the biggest upside and can show the most promise to help Canada's men's national team get to that next level, you think?
Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know if I could pick just one, but I think it...
You don't have to. You can go.
Right. Well, I'll go via the team parts. I think if you look at the between the sticks, it's really a battle for number one there, between Max Crépeau and Dane Sinclair. I think Tom McGill, maybe James Pantemis, another CF Montreal shout there, who's at Portland now and actually battling Max Crépeau at club level. With Neville to see who's got the net there, who's got the gloves. So that will be a good battle. I think the profile and the who Jesse Marsh sees between the sticks, I think the nod or the edge goes to Dane Sinclair, even though Max Crépeau, every time he pulls on a Canada kit, is absolutely more than reliable. He's always lights out and brings his A game. I think look to Fougerol, because when you look at Canada since Jesse Marsh took over about a year ago, he immediately in those two, almost like that baptism by fire where they played France and they played the Dutch, you had that center back pairing of Derek Cornelius and Moise Bumbido. So Cornelius has been injured. He's reinserted into the lineup with De Fougerol next to him against El Salvador, but I mean, it's Bobito's injured. And prior to that, you had Waterman and Kamal Miller, who was an important figure when this team played in Qatar. But I think Luc de Fougerol has emerged, and he had a really good performance in that Canadian Shield tournament against the Ukraine and against Côte d'Ivoire. And strangely, John, it wasn't a shield that got given to the winner. It was actually a trophy. So a little bit of a juxtaposition and a strange one there. But I mean, I think he might have the most upside, still a teenager and showing so much potential there for development, and maybe a guy for a number of cycles who gets the nod as maybe somebody filling in for when those two, like Cornelius or Bumbido, are injured, like Bumbido is currently. Then you look at the midfield, and that's the most pressing matter, I think, where you need to figure out who are your nailed on starters. So Stefan Eustachio, who hasn't featured here, and rumors are that he's back in Europe. He goes back after Porto's eliminated in the Club World Cup. He has been missing for me. I think you see a reliance on the Mathieu Chouinard on the set pieces. You've got Nicolas Gagnon, who used to work for CF Montreal as well, be involved in Quebec soccer, was the set piece coach for Southampton. And he was in Turkey for a little while too, was part of Jesse Marsh's technical staff. So you see like a need for Canada to be better there. And the service of Mathieu Chouinard gives him kind of a tick in the pro column for his inclusion as a starter in Jesse Marsh's 11 or his preferred 11. But Nathan Saliba and what he's been able to do and show for the national team has been extraordinary. And Nico Seeger, his versatility, whether as a fullback or a center midfielder, I'm going through the entire 11 here. So I'm going to fast forward here, but lots of players with highest potential, but I think it has to come back to where the pun's the easiest. The guy with the most promise has to be Promise David. He's known as Toby to his teammates, but I think you see that excellent chance that he had. It was Derek Cornelius from that left channel on his right foot. So it's an in-swinger and it's on a back post. That should be in the back of the net. And that is something he will go back and look at. Jesse Marsh will ask more of him. And I think that he gets the nod is part of that attacking tandem again with Jonathan David, because I think there's so much there that can be developed, not only in his individual kind of attributes and what his ceiling is as a player on the international stage, but what the two of them together can produce for Canada in that final third.
Two questions before we let you go and actually have an existence on a Wednesday. Canada, Guatemala on the weekend, you're the early start. Heavy favorite, prohibitive favorite at a -278. What kind of a matchup are you anticipating against Guatemala 4:00 Eastern time on the weekend?
I don't think it'll be as anti-football as the matchup against El Salvador was, but it'll be a similar, you know, a cagey, combative stop-start affair where Guatemala is going to do everything in their favor or in their power, to throw Canada off their rhythm and off their game. But I think Canada's better... in a better served or in a better position to navigate that a bit better. There are lessons that they learned even in this short window where one, as a player, you don't want to get injured. So they're going to have to move the ball faster. And I think there'll be a willingness to do that. I think they'll also have a plan with if a team is sitting in a low block, which I expect Guatemala might do, is to move the ball, break lines, keep the ball central, and then spray it wide, and then come back again, create overloads, obviously win free kicks in dangerous areas, but attack the box more effectively and more consistently and threaten, because that first half, while it was disappointing in everything that it was in terms of, you know, the product, and it was unwatchable, like Canada just weren't as clinical as they could have been, as they should have been in that final third and that final decision making. So if they're able to maybe get off, get out of the blocks a little bit quicker, maybe get on the board, I think you see it not being an easy contest, because it's always going to be challenging, but I think they're able to deal with it and navigate an opponent like Guatemala a little bit more effectively. And then you get that clash, that set up for the semifinals, where I think we had the discussion on Footy Prime today, like, do you like them in this side of the draw? You know, you're able to avoid Panama and Mexico because you're on this side, but you also get a U.S. that has faltered, but then all of a sudden, even without some key players, are 3-0 and are looking really good. But I think that's set up for a pretty pretty exciting semifinal clash against the U.S. if they're able to get the job done against Guatemala.
Yeah, very, very spicy, as we're looking forward to that. Now, we have in our grid, we have the Twitch pitch, where we have our constant conversation going on with our viewers and our listeners, and they sit there and they have thoughts. Yeah. And one of our plus ones, Abby, wanted to know, if you still have your Atlanta beat jersey.
I do. And I wonder if Abby remembers what our theme song was for the Atlanta Beat. I know that she won't be able to answer, but it was "We've Got the Beat." Oh. Remember that song? Yes.
Yes. You got the go.
Yeah, it Absolutely. Was unbelievable. Yeah, like halcyon days, really, as an international playing first for the Bay Area Cyber Rays. With Tish Venturini and Brandi Chastain, and then getting shipped over to Atlanta, but having a fabulous time and playing at Bobby Dodd Stadium. But
yes.
Wonderful days. But I still have it. Still have my Beat jersey.
See, and I still have, buried in my stacks, I still have the old school double blue. I've got the golf shirt, the old double blue golf shirt, the light blue. I still have
Amazing.
That one. That is a part of, well, I'm one of those guys that will grab gear and I'll hang on to it. And, you know, I may not wear it or whatever. I mean, I still have, I probably still have the program from the championship game at Foxborough and all of those things that were a part of that. And so let's see. All right. So now you're having my memory. So it's Sunwin. And from what I remember, folks were telling me that Sunwin should never have been allowed to drive a car. or at least be in a car with her while she was driving, because she was rather, how do we say, adventurous when it came to driving Atlantis. So you had the Augustiniak sisters, you had Cindy Cohn, Brianna Scurry was in net, Carrie Gregg was one of the local players that was a part of it, and Tommy Stone was the head coach. And then after that, he kind of stayed in the pros a little bit, then went to Texas Tech. And so all of these memories come flooding back when people start talking about Atlanta.
Yeah, and then where's the Canadian connection as well? Because you had myself, you had Sherelta Nonan, you had Charmaine Hooper.
Yes.
Good representation on that Atlanta Beat. And Cindy Parlow, right? So now Cindy Parlow Cone, USSF president. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so being at Herndon, being at Bobby Dodd, I mean, I thought that Herndon was an underrated venue, but, and a lot of folks now are saying that Herndon Stadium on the campus of Morris Brown needs to be raised and renovated to be that hub in the West End now to go back to where it was back then. So, so we completely went on tangents down here. And so no real shock. Go ahead and hit the promo for everybody that doesn't know about what's going on at Footy Prime so they can pay attention to what you are doing, as you are the voice of wisdom and common sense in that group with what's going on at Footy Prime.
Yeah, no, Footy Prime is fabulous. It's a treat to be able to, and a privilege to talk about the beautiful game here in Canada, but we are that insightful and sometimes absurd voice of football, but you have the credibility in myself and Craig Forrest and Jimmy Brennan as the ex-pros for Canada. But we also have a women's football focused chat, which is called the Broadcast, and we talk about our women's national team as well as the Northern Super League, which is the new women's pro league up here and actually available in the U.S. as well. Like, there are some games that are streamed on NSL.ca, but all on YouTube as well. And ESPN Plus is carrying some of our RTSN games up here. But I wanted to say to you, John, maybe next time, if you have me back in the future, I will sport the Atlanta Beat jersey as long as you promise to unearth that baby blue polo.
Oh, see, if I think I know the closet and the space, because I traditionally try to hang those things, especially with age, so they don't get damaged a whole lot. And try to keep them out of the laundry as much as possible, because you don't want me doing laundry because everything magically shrinks like 9 sizes. I will find. Oh, and by the way, for the folks that might have been doing the Google search, there's a picture right here of you in a Grolsch jersey from 2006 with Laval Comets, I guess, by process of elimination.
Yeah, that was the W League. I think USL, so it was called semi-pro, but there was nothing professional about the outfit. But it was a good time, and we were sponsored by Grolsch, so it did mean that post-game, whether you won or lost, that you had a beer waiting for you, which is not a bad thing.
Right. Absolutely true. So as I tell all of our guests, you now have the garage door opener. You know where the keys are under the mat. You know where the magnet is. So if there's anything that you ever want to talk about at any time, just literally yell and sit there and dive in, and we can sit there and have conversations in chaos. You know, obviously, that as the Gold Cup continues, we're going to be circling back with our friends at Footy Prime. And I think that we are actually going to have, once the tournament is over, we're going to have an extravaganza in the 9 o'clock Eastern hour where all of us get together here, and we both can have it. We will be live here, and you guys can have it for tape later.
Amazing.
So everybody from Footy Prime and as many folks from here that want to hang out can hang out here, and we'll have the big Gold Cup extravaganza here on the morning show. So thank you for stepping into the breach and coming in with your lightsaber and being the voice of wisdom and being the voice of relevance here this morning on the morning show. I cannot thank you enough. And do not be a stranger, obviously, you know, with our relationship that is going on. I'm supposed to go to a link. Oh, okay. So there's a Google link.
Really?
Okay. So Abby just posted a Google link.
Oh, no.
All right. So Abby's like, I'm guessing Abby has now Abby. All right. So I'm showing the link.
Abby I'm so scared.
Shoot me this. So, all right. So Abby. Shoot me this because I can't click and paste because of the way the Twitch pitch is orchestrated. Shoot me this link in an email or a DM. And so that way I can send it to Amy. And I'm guessing, Abby has an Atlanta Beach shirt. So that's okay. So, all right. So shoot me this link so we both can watch it and see what's going on. We've opened up a Pandora's box that I do not think we can be able to close. Not that there's anything.
Yeah, I'm
wrong.
Just always fearful of what a Google Photos search is going to like unearth for me, at least as in terms of those late 90s and early 2000s. It ain't pretty.
Yeah. So, all right. So, Abby will send this link, and I'll send this link to you, and we'll both probably be scared, intimidated, and go hide under
Correct.
The table. As always, thanks for dropping by. Do not be a stranger in any circumstance. Obviously, as both teams continue to progress, we'll be knocking on Footy Prime's door, and I know that Footy Prime, Maddie Cruz apparently has become an MVP.
Oh, she was brilliant. So, she can come back anytime.
That is scary. Oh, it's her personal drive. Okay. Go get breakfast, go get brunch, go get your coffee, go get hydrated. Do not be a stranger. Once again, thanks for the intel about the Canadian team. We will catch up with you soon, my friend. Do not be a stranger.
I will not. It was a treat chatting with you, and I'll be back anytime you want me to have or want to have me on.
As always, great to catch up with our friends at Footy Prime as well and find out what's on their mind as Canada continues their new stage of growth in the men's national team and the men's national program with their head coach, Jesse Marsh. That is another go-round of SDHAM on the SDH Network. Once again, catch SDHAM Monday through Friday, 9:05 a.m. Eastern Time on the SDH Network, live on SDH YouTube, on SDH's X and Twitch accounts at twitch.tv/soccerdownhere. And you can be a part of our conversations and discussions. If you catch us live, you can comment in the Twitch pitch. You can also listen to segments with our favorite pundits. And you can listen to shows on your favorite podcatcher, Spreaker, being our head end and our main distribution platform. That's Speaker with an R in the middle, Spreaker.com. Search for Soccer Down Here in the SDH Network. For everybody at the SDH Network, I'm John Nelson. Thanks for dropping by for another go-round of the best of SDHAM. Mucha plata, y'all. Played safe. Enjoy your weekend. We'll catch you up with you next time.